All rise. The Intermediate Court of Appeals is now reconvened. The Honorable Craig H. Nakamura, Daniel R. Foley, and Catherine G. Leonard presiding. Please be seated. Case number 29930, Gabriel Apolando versus the State of Hawaii. Delaney Prescott Tate for appellant, Jeffrey Hawk for appellee. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Ms. Prescott, before you start, let me. I understand there's you plan to play a tape recording during your oral
Correct.
Argument. Have you advised your opposing counsel of that plan?
Yes, I have.
Do you have any objection to that?
I have no objection.
All right, so that's fine. You just understand that any time that's taken playing the tape is going to count against your oral argument
yes.
time.
Yes.
All right,
yes.
please proceed.
Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Delaney Prescott Tate on behalf of the State of Hawaii. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. We're here today for one reason and one reason only. It's because Gabriel Apolando could not follow the terms and conditions of parole. First, I would like to set forth a few things that I think the state and defense counsel can agree with. When the prosecution is accused of breaching the plea agreement, the first case everyone looks to is Santabello v. New York. And out of Santabello came three established principles. And they are that when a plea agreement rests in any significant degree on a promise or agreement of the prosecutor, be that an oral or a written promise, so that it can be said to be part of the inducement or consideration, such promise must be fulfilled. Second, the state agrees that the staff of the prosecution is a unit and each member must be presumed to know the commitments made by any other members. And lastly, when the plea agreement is not kept by the prosecution in choosing a remedy, the defendant's preference should be given considerable weight, inasmuch as the fundamental rights flouted by the prosecutor's breach are those of the defendant. Okay, we have absolutely no problem with those principles. Now, in Santabello, when the prosecution was found in breach of the plea agreement, two remedies are mentioned.
Counsel, just interrupt you for a minute. Before we even get to the breach of the plea agreement, why wasn't the Rule 40 petition dismissed as moot? The whole plea agreement was revolving around the setting of the minimum. The minimum had been served. So why was the Rule 40 not dismissed as moot?
That's a good question. How the Rule 40 even came about was the alleged breach of the plea agreement was not providing protection for Mr. Apolando while he was in custody. There was no mention whatsoever about the missing plea agreement letter. So I don't know why Judge Chan, the state's position is that it was totally meritless and should have been denied as for failing to state a colorable claim because it was all nonsense.
Okay, but if it was not moot, there was a breach here. Is that not correct?
That breach was not discovered until March 17th of 2009.
Right, but that goes to the timing of it.
Of the Rule 40.
Of the breach. We're saying there was a breach,
yes.
But it was late discovered.
That's correct.
Okay, so, all right.
So you're conceding there was a breach? So
well,
in other words, our focus is on what to do as a consequence of the
yes. During the hearings before Judge Chan, the prosecutor did concede there was a breach.
Okay.
But Ms. Wada remembered writing a letter. The letter that was submitted was found in her computer. And what happened to it? Nobody knows.
All right, but let's go back. So in other words, nobody disputes that there was a promise as part of the plea agreement, that the prosecutor would write a letter to the parole commission.
Right.
All right. The parole commission, it's clear, had a hearing apparently very soon after sentencing in which they did not have this letter.
8 days later. Eight days after sentencing.
Well, is there anything in the record that explains why it is that, is that an unusual timing or why it is that,
that
it happened?
That is unusual. The rule says you have 6 months to hold your minimum hearing. He, and it was mentioned on the record that he had requested walk-in parole because he was out on supervised release at the time of sentencing. The judge denied staying the minimus, and so he had already had this hearing date set up. And so this might be a good time to go to see how Ms. Wada's recommendation got before the parole board. And this is Glenn Choi talking.
So for the record, can you explain what you're about to play?
This is how Ms. Wada's plea agreement was put before the paroling authority.
So this is a tape recording of the proceedings on October 8th?
Correct.
All right.
And they have were submitted into evidence at the May 14th hearing.
Now, he does well, he does outstanding. And because of that, the prosecutor on the whole case, Lori Wada, has agreed to make a recommendation for the 1 year minimum term that we're asking for. That's why we asked for a walk-in term here, so that he can walk in and walk out. She did not submit a letter of solid evidence in court, say to the judge that she agrees to the 1 year minimum term. And this is how it happened. I stated to the judge that he had to do very well. I said, I submitted this transcript to the board. It's also attached in the pre-sentence report. So, on the record, the change of the year, I said to the judge, may I, and this is my interject, although it's not part of the agreement property, we have an understanding with the prosecution, not the prosecution, but by the board, regards to the limitation of 1 year as far as minimum term. In light of the fact that Mrs. Afilava has done very well on supervised release, says that he has taken over the family appliance repair business. He's reconciling with his wife. He had a falling out with her when he got into drugs, which led to these sort of cases by the air reconciliation. He went to my brother's keeper, and he has a full clinical discharge from Dr. Jerry McBrennan, and he has an excellent standing with ISC counselor Franklin Young. In light of all this, there is a 1 year recommendation. Ms. Wada is recorded here. Ms. Wada says that's correct. So the prosecutor sees what he has done. I'll basically change his life around. We have the expert saying that that's Dr. Graham, saying that he's motivated and he has made some real lifestyle changes. So seeing that the prosecutor has made his commitment to make this 1 year recommendation for the minimum term. Again, well, the much stronger recommendation or endorsement for his general candidate use than the prosecution endorsing or agreeing to a 1 year minimum term.
Okay. We'll get back to you, sir, in 2 to 3 weeks on this. We'll set the minimum. We'll discuss as well as suggestions to the court. And if parole is warranted immediately, then you need to get those in here. We need to talk about this a little bit. So we'll get back to you. But thank you.
So that's how Ms. Wada's recommendation got before the paroling authority. And at the end, they did say that they were going to consider her recommendations to the court. And
so analytically, how does that fit into your argument with respect to the breach?
I mean,
the prosecutor didn't promise that the defense lawyer would make known to the parole commission what the prosecutor's recommendation was. The prosecutor says she would write a letter to the parole commission, which she didn't do. So how does the fact that the issue was raised at the parole commission, how does that affect whether or not there was a breach, and how does that affect your analysis as to the trial judge being wrong in vacating the conviction based upon the breach?
Well, Lori did write the letter. It was dated November 1st.
Right, but it's too late.
But
it's after the decision.
Yeah, right.
All right, so it can't be that the defendant was bargaining for a letter that arrived after the parole commission made its decision.
Okay, so it's noted on the record before the paroling authority that the letter was not before the paroling authority. Defendant at that point could have continued the hearing if it was that important to have that letter before the paroling authority. Section 706-669, subsection 7 of the Hawaii Revised Statutes, which sets forth the procedures for determining the minimum term of imprisonment, gives the state the right to be represented at the hearing by the prosecuting attorney, who may present written testimony and make oral comments, and the authority shall consider such testimony and comments in reaching its decision. By reading the change of plea transcript into the record, it's the equivalent of written testimony by the prosecutor.
And did the parole commission have the written transcript, or was it just what we just heard?
They were provided with a copy, and then another copy was attached to the pre-sentence report.
So you're really arguing if there was any breach, it was de minimis.
Exactly.
For example, if a letter came from a different prosecutor recommending 1 year instead of from Ms. Wada, clearly that would be a breach of the plea agreement.
Correct.
But it'd be de minimis.
Now, did anybody from the prosecutor's office appear at the parole at that minimum term hearing?
No.
Is that in the record?
Yes. Yeah. Just Mr. Choi and Mr. Apilando were there before the paroling authority. So by October 15th, his minimum was set at 1 year, 6 months. Nobody hears anything from Mr. Apilando. No direct appeal was filed. And he knew that the prosecutor's letter was not before the parole board on October 8th.
He must have been happy with his minimum, right? A year and a half? That's pretty good.
Especially in light of what brought him to be before the paroling authority in the first place. That was in December 24th, 2000, he was involved in the robbery and murder of Mr. Song Marshall, and he is characterized as being the mastermind, that it was all his idea to rob this man because he carried a lot of cash.
But his 1.5 year minimum was for a Class A felony, 20 years?
Correct.
And the guidelines of the Hawaii Paroling Authority have the lowest 2 years, so he actually went below the 2 year minimum.
Because he had that accomplice to attempted escape, at the very beginning of the hearing, they tell him that it is the policy of the paroling authority statewide to not let anybody who is involved in escape of any kind to serve less than 7 years. So right up front, they're telling him, you know, dude, 7 years for the attempted escape. And he ends up getting 1 year and 6 months off of a 20-year term. So we hear nothing about him until he's released on parole. Glenn Choi testified that he did hear from him after his release, and that he may have said something about wanting to file an appeal, but Mr. Choi tells him, you know, it's too late to file your appeal now. So he's all happy and good.
Excuse me. what is the authority, if there is a breach, what is the authority that allows us to determine it's too late, there's a waiver, there's mootness, latches? I mean, what authority do we have to say that it doesn't matter if there was a breach here?
Well, being is that how this case is on appeal, and the lower court went with the Santabello remedies, saying that there are only two remedies for a breach. That is specific performance or allowing the defendant to withdraw his plea and start all over again. And I would submit Santabello is a 1971 case, and since that time, a third remedy, so to speak, has been developed, and that would be to do nothing. And why that, and I did, since our Supreme Court doesn't seem to like federal case law on breaches of plea agreement, I strictly limited my search to states. And if you do it as a contractual analysis, which a plea agreement is essentially a contract, in this case it would be a bilateral contract where the bargain for exchange was Mr. Apilando's promise to plead guilty on the two cases in exchange for the prosecutor writing a letter to the paroling authority recommending a one-year minimum. Okay, so Mr. Apilando did plead guilty, and for some reason, we will never know, the letter did not end up in his file. So once a defendant agrees to plead guilty in reliance on a prosecutor's promise to perform, his due process rights demand fulfillment of the promise. But not all breaches are actionable. And an actionable breach, which is merely, they term it a technical breach, if it's not material or substantial. And a breach is material and substantial if it violates the terms of the plea agreement, which would defeat the benefits that the defendant bargained for. Well, he got what he bargained for. And if not for...
So you're characterizing the bargain as what? He didn't get the letter. That's what
get the letter, but he got a 1.5 year minimum, which is extremely... That was the purpose of the letter. The purpose of the letter was to put before the paroling authority the prosecution's endorsement of his... He had, like, cooperated with the police, and he had performed well while out on supervised release. So,
all right, but how do we deal analytically with the Supreme Court, the Hawaii Supreme Court's structure, which appears to say, and apparently what the trial judge did is to say, okay, one of the issues is whether the defendant would have pled guilty had he known that the prosecutor would not comply with the promise. In other words, the promise induced the plea.
Yes.
And so because the state did not fulfill its promise, that rendered the plea itself, the defendant's giving up of his right to go to trial, involuntary, unknowing,
yeah,
or invalidated in some fashion.
Yeah.
How do we address that aspect of the analysis?
Forfeiture. He forfeited his right to complain by sitting on his rights for 5 years. Well, 4.5 years. He forfeited his right, he received the benefit, and it's only due to his own misconduct that we're even here today.
He forfeited it by what?
Doing drugs, not doing what his parole officer told him to do. And if you haven't listened to the parole revocation tape, I would strongly urge you to do so.
That's in the, that in the record?
Yeah.
What's the basis for the revocation?
He had they don't, because he waives the reading of the charges, he's five violations of which he admits to four with an explanation to the fifth.
And the violations are drug use?
That's the only thing that comes out. The other violations, they say they're written on a piece of paper that I don't have. It's not in the record. But
Has our Supreme Court recognized a forfeiture doctrine in conjunction with plea agreement breaches?
Not with plea agreements, but in the term, in a contractual analysis. That would be like a non-material breach. So,
right, but in the, can you distinguish the majority's view of materiality in State v. Miller? They seem to have a very broad view of that.
The difference between most of the cases in Hawaii where they claim breach of the prosecutor is the time. They immediately move to withdraw their pleas, not wait from October 2004 to March 2009. So I see my time. I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I apologize for being here exactly at 10:15, but this being my first argument before the ICI, I wasn't really sure where to go. I started at the post office, went to the morgue, ended up here.
It's okay, counsel. When I was appointed, I also went to the post office. So.
Well, I took it, going to the morgue was a bad sign for me this morning, but I want to bring up some very fundamental things with you, and that's that my client was charged with robbery in the first degree, for which the potential penalty is 20 years in jail. Also charged with attempted escape, accomplice to attempted escape, which would get him another 10 years. He changed his plea on March 15th of 2004, and when he changed his plea, he changed his life. He changed his family's life. He changed everything about him. He had no prior record. He gave up his fundamental right to a trial. He gave up his liberty. He gave up everything that you and I take for granted. And he did that because Lori Wada promised him a letter in writing that would go to the parole board and recommend 1 year. That's what made him change his mind.
Wasn't that essentially accomplished by providing the paroling authority with the transcripts in court? How were they different? And as opposed to just technically, but in terms of substance, how were they any different?
Well, first of all, I'm a defense attorney. One, nobody believes defense attorneys. So when you go in before the paroling authority is already viewing you skeptically. You have a defendant here that's viewed as these accused of these horrible things, he's pled guilty to these horrible things. You have a defense attorney saying, well, this has been promised, that has been promised. There's supposed to be a letter, and by there being no letter, what does that say to the paroling authority?
But they have the transcript.
They have the transcript.
And look at the minimum itself. For that Class A felony under the guidelines, the lowest minimum they give is 2 years.
Your
client got a year and a half. It seems to me they consider that representation.
We don't know that. What
How else do you explain the year and a half?
Well, I'd like to bring one thing to light here. There was a letter that was submitted, and that submitted letter instead of Lori Wada's letter, a letter came in from Russell Ihara, who was prosecuting the attempted escape. And that letter recommended a 10 out of 10 sentence.
But that was after they already decided.
Well, it's apparent that Lori Watt is not talking to Russ Uehara.
Right, but maybe, but is it, isn't the record clear that the letter, which obviously is a breach of the plea agreement, the letter that was sent recommending 10 years was after the year and a half minimum term had already been issued?
I'm not sure of the timing exactly. I thought it had been submitted to the paroling authority at the time.
The letter's dated November 27th, I think, and the decision is October 15th.
Well, the same holds true of Lori Wada's letter. Lori Wada's proposed letter that
well,
she
that makes a difference, though, because if the Uehara letter is before the parole commission, there's no doubt that that's a violation of the plea agreement. So what I'm asking you, what does the record show with respect to whether or not that 10-year recommended letter was before the parole commission before it rendered its decision?
Right. Okay. That letter must not have been in front of the paroling authority when they made their decision. And I'm not arguing that he didn't get a good deal. What I'm arguing is that he changed his mind based on a promise that wasn't fulfilled. And
he
that's
changed
not
his mind because his parole was revoked, right? I mean, had he just served his minimum, been paroled, we wouldn't be here.
I can't answer that question.
It had nothing to do with the minimum. It had to do with his parole, right?
He was.
I mean, let's be real. Isn't that?
He came back into custody, and that made him question why he was there.
That's why we're here, because he was revoked on parole.
Yes.
Okay.
What I'm trying to get to with the court is that there are inducements to plea. And while we think of a change of plea as simply signing a form or doing a colloquy on the record, it's much, much more than that. The defendant is giving up an incredible amount of rights and changing his life forever.
And let me ask you this, and this might help me focus on the issue. So suppose same facts, but instead of a year and a half, the parole commission gives the defendant a year. You still have a right to withdraw your plea?
I think so. I think what you have to look at is not what he got or what resulted or whether he got the benefit of the bargain, but whether or not he got what he bargained for.
Isn't that pretty hyper-technical? Do you think your client really wanted a letter from Ms. Wada or wanted a low minimum? What did he really want, a letter from her or a low minimum?
Well, he wanted both. He wanted both.
So,
but did he care about the letter if he got the low minimum? Isn't that what he's concerned about, not being in jail after a year? Isn't that what he wants?
I can't answer that. That would be speculating on my part exactly what he wanted at that point. Certainly he wanted a low minimum. He was promised this letter.
In other words, instead of the prosecutor promising the defendant to write a letter, if the promise was you're going to get a year minimum, wouldn't he have taken that?
I don't know. I do know that he insisted on talking to the prosecutor directly at the change of plea. He actually came out and talked to her directly, and she said she would put it in writing. And maybe it was that last thing where she said she'd put it in writing that caused him to change his plea. He didn't change his plea for 3.5 years. I mean, this was an old case. He had held out for a long, long time, maintaining his innocence and wanting to go to trial. And when he heard that 1 year, he'd already served 330 days. That meant, in his mind, 30 more days. And so, in a layperson's mind, what he's looking at is the potential of 20 or 30 years versus 30 days. And this person says, I'm going to make sure it's 30 days for you, in his mind.
Counsel, why wasn't the Rule 40 moot? The whole benefit, you know, I really think this is a case about a minimum, not so much her letter, but if the whole issue revolved around the setting of the minimum and he had served his minimum, why wasn't the petition moot?
Because the damage was already done. That letter served as the inducement.
But the minimum was served. The sentence was served. The minimum sentence was served. So wasn't that issue moot?
I don't believe so.
And why not?
Because he changed his plea in exchange for this letter, and the letter
was. And the letter was for the minimum.
Yes.
And the minimum was served, so that was over, and could not be reset.
I see the way you're approaching the the argument. I understand that, but I don't agree with
it. And you don't agree because?
It doesn't make it moot. He changed his plea. We have to look at that moment when he changed his plea.
If he had served his maximum sentence as well, he could still withdraw his plea?
I doubt he would want to do that. But
you know, we're dealing with hyper-technicalities here. So he could still do that had he served his maximum plea as well?
If the breach was an if there was an inducement to plea and that inducement was breached in some way, then yes, he could withdraw his plea.
After
he served the whole term. I don't see why not. He could choose to go back and go
certainly
to trial.
Certainly case law to the contrary, but that's okay. I mean, it wasn't briefed. The issue of mootness wasn't briefed, and I was surprised it was never raised. Not to say it is or isn't moot, but certainly it's a reasonable issue to raise.
Let me ask you this, though, on the forfeiture issue. As of October 8th, obviously he realizes that the prosecutor has not fulfilled the promise to write a letter. The parole commission, in a week or so later, issues the year and a half minimum. He doesn't seek to withdraw his plea or do anything until after he's revoked. Now, doesn't that suggest, or is that relevant to the question of whether there was a material breach in the plea agreement, or that he didn't get the benefit of his bargain, because apparently even after he knew the facts which would have permitted him to seek withdrawal of his plea, he doesn't do it. He doesn't do it until something else happens, which is he gets revoked on his parole.
And are you asking for an explanation of why that happened, or?
I'm asking for analytically, doesn't that suggest that he in fact got the benefit of his bargain because he didn't complain about it? And his predicament now is not related to any breach of the plea agreement. It's related to the fact that he violated the conditions of his parole.
Well, I see what you're saying in that he got out and, you know, once defendants get out, they're very happy. They go about their lives. And I think what the court's trying to say is that since he didn't raise that issue at the time, that it's moot, but there is some evidence from the record that he was trying to contact Glenn Choi about appealing, and the period for the appeal had run. So there were concerns there on his part. He had been contacting Glenn Choi. He had been trying to get in touch with him.
Yeah, but even if his appeal time on the direct appeal had run, he could have followed Rule 40 and done what you did in this case, saying the prosecutor promised to write a letter. There's no letter. I want to withdraw my plea because those facts are in the record.
I can't speak as to why he didn't file the Rule 40 earlier. I don't have that information. The state brought up the idea of him being some sort of mastermind and behind this entire crime, and I just wanted to address that one thing. And the prosecutor will always use the word mastermind when it's clear that the defendant didn't do anything. This was basically, they had someone saying that he thought it up, that it was his idea, that, you know, this was all his idea, which means they don't have any actual physical evidence of him doing anything.
Right, and just no indication in the record that anything changed from the time the prosecutor agreed to recommend 1 year and his minimum was set, right? There's no intervening, he committed a crime or anything like that. So the prosecution, knowing what the facts were, had promised that they were going to recommend a year.
Correct. So while the court may view it as a technical violation or it's he got the benefit of the bargain or he should have raised the point earlier, I have to keep coming back to the same point, and that's that Gabriel Apolando wanted his trial.
A question. If Ms. Wada didn't write the letter, found out she didn't write the letter, the parole hearing's happening, that the setting of minimum hearing is happening that morning, she goes over herself, makes an appearance, I recommend a year, didn't write the letter, would that be a violation of the plea agreement?
I don't think we'd be here today if that had happened.
Why is the transcript that different?
Because of the voice it's coming from. The vo- voice is the voice of the defense attorney and not the voice of the state. The voice of the state would have made a...
I mean, wasn't it Ms. Wada's voice in the transcript?
No.
Wasn't her speaking in the transcript?
She wasn't at the parole hearing.
Didn't they provide a transcript of the plea? Am I missing something?
Oh, I see. Of the plea, yes. There's a transcript of the change of plea.
And that's her voice in the transcript, right?
Yes.
So what I'm saying, the transcript's there. Her voice through the transcript is there. Versus no letter and physical presence. I mean, what's the difference?
The difference is that it's there in writing. It's why he changed his plea. It's what he bargained for. If I bargain, I'm going to give you $10. You're going to give me a pepperoni pizza. There's no pepperoni
okay,
on
so
it.
So he bargained for the letter.
Yes.
So if she didn't write the letter and showed up in person, would that be a breach of the plea agreement? I mean, we wouldn't be here if parole wasn't revoked. We all know that. But
right.
We're just talking about the plea agreement. If she didn't write the letter and she showed up in person, would that be a breach of the plea agreement?
Technically, yes.
And would that be a basis for him to withdraw his plea?
I think it would be much weaker if.
Why?
Because, I mean, if she had showed up, then I think that would have carried a lot more weight. That would have carried more weight with the parole board.
So sometimes a breach can be harmless error on the part of the state.
I would say that there are probably some breaches that are harmless.
Right.
But in this case, it wasn't because of what Mr. Apollando said.
An indication it was harmless? A year and a half minimum, isn't that? Given the guidelines, given the lowest minimum you can set for 20 years is two,
he gets
a 1.5, isn't that evidence that it was harmless?
No, he wanted to go to trial and win. He wanted to clear his name. He wanted to...
I'm talking about the effect of the breach, not what he wanted.
Okay, the effect of the breach is that he changed his plea. That is the...
No, as far as the minimum.
As far as the minimum, he got a year and a half. He didn't get a year.
Well, does the tolling authority always do exactly what the prosecutor
certainly
recommends?
Not. Certainly not. I mean, we never know where they're going to end up. But I keep coming back to the same point, and that's that he changed his plea because of this promise of a letter, and the letter didn't come. Now, the defense attorney tried to patch that up as best he could by bringing in a transcript, but, you know, the reason that Gabe Apollando changed his plea was the promise of this written letter.
You would concede there's no bad faith, the Office of Prosecutor, in this. As the prosecutor indicated, statute provides 6 months. My experience, it usually is within 4 or 5 months. This one happened a lot earlier. You're not suggesting there was any bad faith, are you?
I can't say that there was. I can't say that there was any malfeasance on their part other than failing to submit the letter. So while the court may be looking for a way to grant the appeal.
These are just questions to stimulate discussion, counsel. We haven't made up our mind.
Okay. I've done a lot of change of pleas over the years, and people change their lives in a moment, and that moment has to be looked at very, very carefully about whether or not this person was promised something that wasn't delivered. And the reason for that is there are just so many ramifications of changing your plea to a felony charge. You lose your right to vote. You lose your right to keep and bear firearms. You lose your right to your freedom. And if that agreement is not strictly enforced, then I think we get on a slippery slope where we start to say, well, you got a transcript, you didn't get a letter, so we're going to say a transcript is okay. Then you're going to get down into the nitty-gritty of what's a material breach and what's not a material breach. I agree that in some cases there are probably breaches that aren't material, that won't make a difference. But If you come back to that day where on March 15, 2004, when Gabe Apollando changed his plea, he did that for a particular reason, and that's because he was going to get a letter from the prosecutor, and he never got that. And the only remedy to that is for him to be able to withdraw his plea.
So your argument is that he bargained for the letter, he didn't bargain for the result. He didn't care about the result. In other words, if he got a year, even though the prosecutor didn't comply, because he bargained for the letter and not the what the actual result of the letter, that it would be a material breach.
He bargained for the letter. I don't think a defendant is thinking that far down the line when he's changing his plea to a felony. He's not playing chess.
Isn't he really thinking how much time am I going to have to serve?
Certainly, he's thinking 30 more days if I get this letter. That was what was going through his mind. I'm going to have to serve 30 more days, not 20 years. And that's...
In response to Judge Nakamura's question, if he got a year, fine. With no letter.
I see what you're saying. I think Santabello takes up or addresses this issue when it says, you know, it's not whether or not the government or the judge considered it, but it's from Miller, that when a plea agreement is breached, the focus is not on the error of the sentencing authority, but on the prosecution. The touchstone of Santabello is whether the prosecution met its commitment and not whether the court would have adopted the government's recommendation. So,
but in Miller, the agreement was for the prosecution not to argue against the deferred acceptance plea. The court construed it as an argument against the deferred acceptance plea, and the defendant did not get the deferred acceptance plea. That's quite a bit different than this case.
I understand that, but when someone's promised something, they should get the benefit of that promise, regardless of the outcome. I think, and the reason it's so important in this case is that this is not buying a pizza or changing a plea to an abuse case. It's a felony. It's a Class A felony.
So you think our analysis should focus strictly on why the defendant pled guilty? In other words, if this letter was what caused him or induced him to plead guilty and give up his constitutional right to trial, then the rest of it is all irrelevant. That's the focus.
Yes.
And as long as he bargained for something and the state didn't comply with it, whether ultimately he ended up getting a good deal or a bad deal, shouldn't matter.
That's correct. Because I think that's really what caused Gabe Apollando to change his plea, was this final promise of a letter. And if the letter's not there, then the state did not follow through. And if the state didn't follow through, regardless of what the eventual outcome was, he should be allowed to withdraw his plea.
Is the withdrawal of the plea the only remedy under the law?
In this situation, I think that is the only viable one, since, I mean, he could be resentenced, but that doesn't really make any sense in this situation to resentence him, because he's going to get the open 20. I mean, we're going to go back to square one again. So I think in this situation, what the law would provide for is for him to change his plea. Are there any other questions? Am I out of time? Almost. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to address a couple of Mr. Hawk's comments regarding the delay in him pleading guilty. He filed several pretrial motions, and it took 18 hearings and 2 years for his pretrial motions to be disposed of. After the hearings, the state entered into cooperation agreements with 3 of the 5 suspects. All 3 of these co-defendants were set to testify against Mr. Apilando. The 5th individual had pled guilty without a deal. So that's the setup on March 15th, 2004. He's looking at trial alone, and 3 of his co-defendants are set to testify against him.
And he's weighing that against 30 more days in jail.
Exactly. And the judge had indicated that he would concurrent sentence. So as to Mr. Uehara's letter, it was in fact dated November 26, 2004, 6 weeks after the minimum was set. The minimum didn't change.
But that was a screw-up, though.
And oh, definitely was.
Writing a letter after they promised to recommend a year.
Definitely the left hand did not know what the right hand was doing.
So you're just lucky that the decision was made before that letter
got there. In State v. Anderson, it was a breach of plea agreement case. They found that where the letter came after the decision, it was irrelevant. So, yes, we were very lucky in that regards. So Mr. Apilando did virtually nothing to enforce the plea agreement, despite the knowledge that the parole board did not have the one-year recommendation letter. And when you're looking at the remedy, you look at the totality of the circumstances. And in this case, if you look at everything together, the defendant got the bargain of the plea agreement. There was not a substantial and material breach. And the only reason why he's complaining now is because he's in jail. He blew the chance that was given him, and the judge rewarded him for it by allowing him to withdraw his plea and set the matter for trial 10 years after the offenses occurred. Now, in the meantime, witnesses have died. All of the evidence on the escape case has been destroyed. The detectives all have retired. Witnesses have left HPD. Witnesses have gone to the mainland. So the state is really been placed in an awkward position to have to retrial a case now 10 years after the fact.
But that wouldn't matter if there was a material breach, right?
A material breach
of the plea agreement.
Exactly. If he
had, there'd be no material breach if the state complied with its plea.
Right. Or if he didn't get the benefit of the deal. But he did get what he bargained for. Remedies vary with the nature of the broken promise, and the facts of each particular case need to be taken into consideration.
But we do have the Supreme Court's very strong language in State versus Miller, and perhaps you can help us with our analysis. And in discussing Sanabella, the majority says, hence, according to the Supreme Court, referring to the United States Supreme Court, the interests of justice require, and that is italicized, that the appropriate relief be granted in the face of a breach of a plea agreement, regardless of whether the breach affected the sentencing decision, period. It is the breach in and of itself that is the injustice. How do we get over that hurdle, assuming we are inclined to?
Well, this would be a case of first impression. Again, in Miller, it was an immediate, you know, immediately brought to the attention of the court.
So you say the distinction is that in Miller it was fixable, here it's not?
Too much
that's,
time.
That's the way to distinguish Miller?
Well, it was immediate in most of the cases. You know, is their finding of manifest necessity. How can it be manifest necessity when he sat on his rights for 4.5 years?
Under Mr. Hawk's analysis, isn't the issue whether the defendant would have pled guilty if the promise was we're going to go to the parole hearing, nobody from the state's going to show up, and we're going to read the plea transcript in which the prosecutor agrees that it's a year, that she's going to recommend a year? Isn't that the issue? Under his analysis, if the defendant would have pled guilty under those facts, there's no material breach.
No harm, no foul.
Or how do we decide that issue, whether he in fact would have or wouldn't have pled guilty under that scenario?
By looking at the facts of the case. He knew he didn't have the letter. He was perfectly happy to accept his 1.5 years. He did nothing until December of 2008. If he was that unhappy with how he received the benefit of the plea agreement, he was perfectly capable of writing a letter to Judge Chan back in November when he's still, his 30 days and he's still in jail had gone by. But he didn't. He didn't do anything until he was landed back in jail. So this court should not lend its assistance to an accused by allowing him to escape the obligations of the plea agreement after accepting the benefits. As a matter of public policy, he should not be rewarded for his bad behavior.
Despite the broad language in the Miller holding, the facts are certainly distinguishable, aren't they?
Yeah. This is where contract principles help. A breach is forgiven where the party gets the benefit of the deal when the breach is not material and substantial. And in this case, he did get the bargain.
And in Miller, the breach was material and he didn't get the benefit of the bargain.
And it was an immediate response. Here, he just let it go. He was happy. And it was just his inability to abide by the terms and conditions of parole. We wouldn't be here. The state's opinion is that the Rule 40 should never have been granted a hearing at all, and it should have been dismissed because he raised no colorable claim in his Rule 40 petition. And time, like a plea bargain, once spent is gone forever. He spent his plea agreement, and the judgment in this case should stand. Any more questions? Thank you.
Take the case under advisement.
All rise. Court is now adjourned.